Well, when did you get in town?
When was it? Day before yesterday. All this begins to blur together, so...
Are you doing a tour? Nationwide?
Well, let's see. Semi, I guess. I've been to St. Paul. I was on Minnesota Public Radio on Noah Adams' successor show at Prairie Home Companion Saturday night, and then Philadelphia to do a reading at a suburban college down there.
Uh-huh.
Then here, and tomorrow it's Washington, D.C., and then Chicago, stop over on the way home.
You're not going to do the Larry King show, are you?
No, none of that. No, I guess not.
Well, this book's a little too literary for Larry. He likes,
right.
He likes big celebrity authors like ex-Watergate offenders.
Yes, yeah, right.
Things like that. This was a magnificent novel, and I got to like it more and more as I got into it. And there were so many harrowing episodes, the two that... that come to mind, the blizzard, where they're tracking along the fence post.
Mm.
I mean, that certainly was an epic. And, of course, the other exciting thing, in which Rob was killed in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Was really exciting. And then the reader has to read an awful lot to get to those.
Yes.
But, the way you have unfolded all of these characters and everything, it's really marvelous. Now, this was my introduction to your work, and I'm going to have to go back and read more, because this was absolutely wonderful. But this is actually one of a series of books based on many of the same people and episodes and locations. So tell me how all this came about.
Okay, I've begun writing, I guess it was 5 years ago, I began working on a trilogy, which would cover Montana's 100 years of statehood by Hoopla time in 1989. And I began in the middle with a book called English Creek, set during the Depression years, because it was closest to my own memory and time in Montana. It's largely about my dad's generation. And now I'm going to write a book on either side of that, Don. And Dancing at the Rascal Fair is the one that goes back in time to 1889, when this McCaskill family leaves Scotland to homestead in Montana.
How do you keep all this straight, writing backwards like this?
File cards, and I do work with a lot of 5x8 file cards, and note down kind of family characteristics and how characters talk, and just try to keep things orderly in their little boxes as I will look through it, look up the characters, Jick, Angus, whatever generation it is, and see how he talks.
So your forebears go back to Scotland?
Yes, my people left Scotland about 100 years ago from north of the Dundee area and indeed headed for the Montana Hills to homestead.
So your trilogy, in effect, traces your own roots and your own family?
Only the historical fact that it happened. I've been making up this created McCaskill family, Don. They're taller, better looking, better spoken, more poetic in their expression than I am, so I'm deliberately not making them the Doigs.
You yourself grew up in Montana.
Yes, I did.
Now, tell me about that. Tell me about your Montana days.
Okay. My father and mother were ranch workers, particularly on sheep ranches. They were sheep herders. My mother would cook for lambing and haying crews. And I was their only child. I was born in 1939 out there. And in 1945, when I was six, we were in a sheep camp high in the Bridger Mountains out from Bozeman, and my mother died of the asthma, which had plagued her all her life. And so I was then brought up by my dad for the next several years in his kind of itinerant ranch hand life. Babysitting was nothing that ever occurred to us or we knew how to achieve, and so I simply went with him wherever he went, which included the bars of the small town of White Sulphur Springs, a town of 1,000 people that had 9 bars. And in my first book, This House of Sky, a memoir of that period, I did a kind of a tour of those bars as I remembered them. They were distinctive in a lot of ways. One, the Pioneer would be the hiring bar where ranchers would go to try find an irrigator or a sheep herder or a cowboy or whatever. One of the other ones would be the bar of the really hard drinkers, encouraging one another into it. And so I had kind of inadvertently this wonderful tour into adult life, the language, these men trying to keep out the loneliness of the hugeness of Montana. And then that went on for 4 or 5 years. My dad tried a second marriage, which didn't work. And then he came down with severe ulcers, and it wasn't clear what was wrong with him. He maybe wondered if it was going to be stomach cancer or whatever, and so the thought that he might die came to him. And so he made an alliance with my mother's mother, my grandmother, whom he had never gotten along with for many years. But trying to figure out what he was going to do with me, he took that step across several years of silence and enmity of a kind, and approached my grandmother, Bessie Ringer, and said, will you join us in a household? And so I was then brought up by the two of them, and they stayed together until my dad died 25 years later. So we were a three-generation family of my mother's mother and my dad and me.
What an interesting childhood. Where in Montana primarily did you grow up? I know you moved around a lot after you settled down with the grandmother.
I was born in the valley just east of Helena. It's a mile-high valley called the Smith River Valley. And lived there for my first dozen years or so. Then we moved to the part of Montana I really, really prefer, and I'm writing about in these books. It's the area along the east face of the Rocky Mountains, just south of Glacier National Park. And we ran sheep on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation up there along the Two Medicine River. And so I've taken that the actual geography of the Two Medicine River running through and renamed this area the Two Medicine Country, given it a fictitious Two Medicine National Forest for the sake of these books. And so it's the area where the high plains meet the Rockies, and I like that hem country where you can feel the continent changing. You look west and the Rockies soar up. There's kind of there's a line somewhere, I think, in Rascal Fair. It's kind of a running leap of the continent at that point.
You had a rather unlikely childhood for a writer. Was there something in your childhood that gave you any inkling that someday you would be turning out books about Montana?
It turns out that this is really before my memory, but an old family friend tells me that my mother read to me all the time, that and I would follow, I guess, her moving finger on the page or whatever. I can't remember a time when I couldn't read. I went into the first grade in a small Montana school capable of reading any comic book that came to my hands, or even old Life magazines, old Saturday Evening Posts, and Geographics, things of that sort. So I've always, in growing up as a solitary child in this ranch life and kind of knocking around and having to entertain myself, by and large, I've always been a demon reader. And I think that probably is what stuck with me, Don, that I look on the kind of writing I'm trying to do in these books as really attempts to make the language dance and prance, I guess. I'm trying to use the language of Montana in this trilogy. So Rascal Fair has something, I hope, of a Scottish lilt gained by going to Scotland a couple of times and shopping around over there for language. And English Creek was told in the voice of someone of my dad's generation and has a more Western twang to it, I hope. And so I'm the language is really the core of what I'm trying to do in these books.
In Dancing at the Rascal Fair, you have a lot of folk songs in there, and you made it feel as though Rascal Fair was an old line folk song, but I read somewhere in the, I guess an interview in PW or somewhere, that you actually wrote this yourself.
It's a old traditional Scottish tune, which indeed I wrote myself, and that was to possibly give away a trade secret of writers here. That was to justify the title. I had come across this line of Rascal Fair in a very dry Scottish sociology book which was talking about farmers and farm workers in 19th century Scotland. My wife came across this when we were in Edinburgh and said, you better have a look at this. It has a lot of detail, delineates the kind of class structure. And there was one line saying that when farmers and farm workers met to bargain out the summer's wages, the really tough nuts on each side often had to come back a second day. And this was called the Rascal Fair, after the hiring fair, where the rascals, the hard cases, did their bargaining. And so I was quite taken with that phrase, and I got up one morning after a largely sleepless night with that running through my head, and told my wife, I think the title of the book is going to be Dancing at the Rascal Fair. I went out and bought a songwriter's rhyming book and concocted the tune to go with it, Don.
Can you hum it for us?
You know, we faced that problem on Minnesota Public Radio on Saturday night. I was invited to read from Dancing at the Rascal Fair on Noah Adams' new show out there. And they said, well, we're going to have musicians on this show, and so can you do something with that? And I said, well, yeah, there's a dance scene in a one-room schoolhouse here. I'll probably do something. And not dawning on me what I had gotten myself into, because I got back there, and they said, okay, what's the tune? And all I could say is, you know, I only do words. And but we were able to, I had written the songs Rascal Fair and then kind of a couple of others, which I amended from old Scottish ballads, which existed in dozens of varieties. All I knew to do was to parse them like poetry. And so there are a certain number of syllables in each line, and I was able to recite it. But Dancing at the Rascal Fair came out something like, Dancing at the Rascal Fair, devils and angels all were there, heel and toe, pair by pair, dancing at the Rascal Fair. If you can imagine a fiddle going in the background.
Did they have a fiddle in the background?
They did.
That's an easy one to set to music, yeah. Actually. An old, almost any one of a variety
mm-hmm.
of folk songs. Three
yeah,
chords,
there was a fiddler from Kentucky on the show, and with very little trouble, she was able to. The hardest thing, because I have quite a tin ear, the hardest thing was knowing when I was supposed to start and when she was going to follow me. And so she worked out she would hit the strings four times with her bow, and on the fourth one, I'm kind of counting on my fingers, then I would begin reciting, and she would follow me. So
I haven't heard that show yet. I used to be a faithful listener to Garrison Keillor's show
mm-hmm.
when it was on Saturday
mm-hmm.
nights, but I haven't heard the new one yet.
Yeah, it was fascinating to watch this radio show, which is also a live stage performance. And so at 4:20 for the 5 o'clock show, I hear 11 people with various responsibilities gather and begin talking at Noah from all directions of things that need smoothing in the next 40 minutes. And, you know, it was like watching, I don't know, the inner workings of a complicated machine. But it was great fun. And Noah is really quite good and relaxed at it. It's a kind of a talk show host all of a sudden.
Oh, I'm glad I don't have to do that. I just have a one-person
yeah.
broadcast.
Yeah.
I read my own books, ask my own questions,
yeah.
write my own scripts,
yeah, right.
put my own labels on the
right.
tapes,
yeah. yeah.
package them myself, send them off to our syndication unit and all that. So.
Oh, there must have been, you know, 35 people circulating around that stage.
Well, let's go back to you. After high school, you went off to college. Where did you study?
At Northwestern, as a journalism major. And
thank God you didn't go into that.
What? Would the mic situation would simply be reversed, Don. I would be interviewing you, perhaps. Yes, I tinkered with it a bit as an editorial writer for a chain of newspapers in downstate Illinois, and then as assistant editor of a magazine. But I've been a friend of mine who, at least up until the great day on Wall Street, was making his way as kind of an investor in the world. The two of us stay at home while our wives go off to their college jobs, and he's described what we do as self-unemployed. And so I've been a stay-at-home full-time writer now for 17 years, I guess.
How did you become a writer?
It began trying to get out of what looked like a financially bleak future for me in Montana. Because my people were not ranchers, they were the people who worked for ranchers. And so the life as a a ranch hand as kind of the hired muscle in Montana, something I wanted out of. And so about my junior year in high school, I began thinking toward college. And a teacher or two pushed me in the direction of journalism school. And at Northwestern, I took the bachelor's and master's program and came out. I only took, I think, a total of two English courses in my life. And so much of my writing background comes out of the pounded out, set deadlines and meet them kind of writing.
Well, I think I didn't ask the question correctly, because somehow I don't equate journalism with writing. It is so, well, I don't mean that critically. It's so formatted and and predictable. What you've done with your trilogy is creative writing. So I guess I should rephrase the question. How did you become a creative writer?
Well, I became a novelist. This is my third novel. After two nonfiction books in which I was trying to use some fictional techniques, because I was trying to get at stories such as my father's and my grandmother's. This was in the early 70s when I was beginning towards my first book, This House of Sky. And my father was dying of emphysema in Montana at the time, and so I was back there a lot trying to help him cope with that long dying, and I could see that a generation of these kind of leathery guys who had made their lives as cowboys and sheep herders was passing. It was a story that I had grown up on the fringes of and watched and listened to, and it's something I thought I wanted to try to tell. And so with my desire to do this, came the period of the Watergate aftermath, where everybody indicted or was offered a fat book contract, and it shouldn't be underestimated the kind of goad that is to an unindicted writer trying to do something separate. That I thought, you know, there are other stories in this country to be told, and so it did give me quite a push to work at writing the book of my family, my background. And I decided to take as much time as it needed to try make each sentence carry a kind of poetic weight. And so I would write and rewrite and rewrite beyond that. And that's carried over through the five books, that I was able to shift somehow from churning out, in a sense, magazine articles, as I was doing as a full-time freelance, to really living in the language with these books.
How did you happen to move to Seattle?
Carol and I were working at magazine jobs in the Midwest, at Chicago, and we found ourselves spending all weekend to drive up into Door County, Wisconsin, to see fir trees, and it began to dawn on us that the geography of the Midwest had kind of played itself out for us, and we were hungry for the kind of landscape I had grown up with, mountains, and that Carol had sought out. She started out down here on the Jersey Shore, but she has had become a kind of voluntary Westerner. And so we chose Seattle when I decided to go back to graduate school in history. And so we went out there supposedly for 3 years at the University of Washington, and we've now been there 20. And the combination of mountains, the Cascade and Olympic Ranges on either side of us, and the water of Puget Sound leading out to the Pacific seems to be exactly the kind of balance we wanted to be around.
It's a little damp, isn't it?
It is, but it's, Don, it's, I don't know, very, words grow in that damp air as far as I can.
So does fungus.
So does fungus. Well, you try to sort out the fungus and keep the good words.
Are you teaching?
No, I'm doing nothing but write. And the damp, Seattle's gray climate is very congenial to me to hole up in a in a suburb with green, evergreen forest all around, and do so many words a day, so many days a week, and let it pile up into books.
Oh, that sounds like a wonderful life.
Okay.
Really, it does.
Good.
Now, your preoccupation with Montana, why don't you, you must go back to visit Montana a lot so that the landscape is firmly locked in your memory.
Yeah.
But you are, in effect, the poet laureate of Montana.
Well, there's a lot of writing.
I mean, who else writes about Montana?
Well, actually, a place like Missoula, centered on the University of Montana writing program, you walk down the streets of Missoula and you'll meet a published novelist about as frequently as you pass parking meters. James Welch, in particular, my best friend among writers. Jim is part Blackfeet, and he wrote a wonderful book called Fool's Crow last year, which Viking published to considerable acclaim. And Jim is writing about the Native American, the American Indian backdrop of the kind of country I'm writing about. And A.B. Guthrie continues to live and write in Montana, a man who was an example to many of us that indeed Montanans could grow up to be real book writers with his book, well, his trilogy, really beginning with The Big Sky. But I've chosen not to live in the weathers and wind and distances of Montana. I husband my energies, I guess, to focus into the books, and so a suburb seems to be just what I need.
Well, before I let you go, I want to ask you a little bit about the actual craft, the process of writing. You mentioned that you had a lot of index cards and things like that. So how do you go about putting words on paper, doing your research, and executing your books?
Okay. The research, I think, I can best say I rummage. For Rascal Fair, Carol and I went to Scotland, and I hit the archives at the University of St. Andrews, where I had found in archival guides that they had some letters of emigrants writing home about the great voyage to America. And so some of the storm seen, Don, in Rascal Fair of my narrator and his chum crossing in steerage and being buffeted and getting seasick and all the rest, much of that comes from letters of young Scotsmen and Scotswomen writing back and saying, this is what it was like, and everything loose flew from side to side. And this is one of my favorite scenes in the book of the ship comes into Queenstown Harbor near Cork in Ireland, and all of a sudden the bumboats come out with a woman in each boat, and they come climbing up ropes and do a kind of an immediate market on the ship deck. That I came across in these letters at St. Andrews. And so I will go to a library and begin shopping around that way, skimming old diaries and letters and Scottish joke books in this case to try to get the turns of phrase and a few of the jokes that come into the book. One of my characters comments to the other about they're in a situation like the old spinster asked why she never married, and she that was because she said, I wouldn't have the walkers and the riders went by. And so that kind of in-betweenness, dry humor of the Scots was back there in some capacious old joke books.
So that's the research. Now you've piled up all of this material. I assume you photocopied it and made notes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
In your office in the Seattle suburb with the fir trees outside. Now you have to start putting words on the paper. How do you organize this?
I get out a big table, a big folding table, and we'll begin dealing file cards almost like somebody dealing in Las Vegas, I guess, putting them onto a large flat surface and begin moving around these file cards to see if the lines of remembered phrases will begin to make a dialogue, try and make the cards talk to each other in a sense. And so I keep looking for the possibilities, trying to make imagination spring out of all this factual collection lying face up on the in the file cards at me.
Well, you've done a marvelous job with Dancing at the Rascal Fair. It's a book that as you get into it, you don't want to stop reading. And I guess magnificent is a way to phrase it. And I'm anxious to read the third in the trilogy, right? The third part
mm-hmm,
is already done, right?
The third one is going to be on its way in a couple of years.
No. Let's see. Wait a minute. The middle one is.
The middle one is done.
Yeah, it's going to be better when you get everything finished. We can read
really
from beginning to end.
It'll be much simpler for readers. I apologize to the readers of the world.
Well, Ivan Doig, it's a wonderful book, and thank you very much for taking the time to talk.
Thanks very much, Don.